I'll call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is May 23rd, 2011. We are convened for the purpose of public hearing and possible work session on four bills and a work session on another. And to give a sense of the order, what I'd like to do is to move the work session to House Bill 3030A up to number one, and then we will go to 2613, 2614, 2083A, and 2084. And I appreciate the Department of Consumer and Business Services allowing the others to come before it. That being said, I will open a work session on House Bill 3030A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3030A, we heard on May 2nd, it's the measure that exempts from minimum wage standards certain individuals that provide volunteer golf course marshal services. The measure, just to recap, had a House vote of 59-1. There's no fiscal or revenue impact for the measure, and we have no amendments to the measure, Mr. Chair.
All right. We heard this not too long ago. Senator George, you feel comfortable making the motion?
I do. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3030 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 3030A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, please call the roll.
Senator Bonamici.
Aye.
Senator Boser.
Excused.
Senator Monroe.
Excused.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
And Chair Hughes.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator George, would you carry that?
Sure.
All right. I'll close the session on House Bill 3030A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2613. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2613 comes to the House on a, through the House on a vote of 59-0. The measure allows the deposit of public funds in an Oregon depository in excess of the statutory limit if the depository redeposits into insured accounts and other financial institutions, if the redeposited funds are federally insured, and the Oregon depository receives an amount of deposits from other financial institutions in at least an equal amount. The measure has no revenue impact. A minimal fiscal impact was issued on the House side. There are no amendments to this measure. And we have been requested by the Senate President's office to, if the committee moves this bill, to send it to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. All bills of this type, apparently, I'm told by the Senate President, are going to Senate Revenue, Mr. Chair.
All right. Could we please bring up Linda Navarro and Mark Stevenson? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 2613. 2613 is actually a pretty technical bill, but it does have some implications for a bank's ability to lend and economic development in Oregon's communities. Several years ago, legislation was passed that allowed banks to utilize a product called CDARS for public funds, and it's a reciprocal deposit relationship with other community banks around the country so that a depositor can have insurance on their deposit above current FDIC insurance limits of $250,000. So a depositor could put several million dollars on deposit in a local bank, and the bank would have those dollars to deploy in their community, but they actually are sharing those deposits in exchange for reciprocal deposits with other institutions so that the insurance of those deposits is maximized and shared among multiple institutions. So it's a diversification of those large dollars, but it provides that full protection to depositors. This is a product that's accepted by the bank regulatory agencies, utilized by individuals and small businesses, and by public entities in the state of Oregon. More recently, there's been an addition to that suite of products that works for money market deposit accounts that are also insured deposits, but they're more transactional in nature as opposed to a certificate of deposit. And so those are available now to individuals and businesses in Oregon. And what this legislation does is expand the statute to allow those deposits to be utilized for public entities as well. So once again, between CDARS and this program, it provides public entities with a product in which those deposits would be insured, and it's essentially an alternative to collateralizing those deposits under Oregon's Public Deposit Protection Program, which is still in use for deposits. In fact, it's required when there is an insured product. But it is very expensive, and as I think I've testified to this committee before, those deposits end up being tied up pretty much dollar for dollar for a community bank. When you have to collateralize at 100%, for example, or even at 75%, for every dollar deposits you take in, you have to turn around and buy a security, particularly small banks, which don't have, you know, the balance sheets to support a lot of pledging of collateral by just moving balance sheet items around. So they have to go out and buy a security. So you can't lend that money out when you're turning around and buying a dollar of pledged collateral for every dollar of deposit. This allows a bank to take those deposits, utilize an insured vehicle for those deposits, and therefore those deposits can turn around and be lent out. So that's how it has an implication with regard to lending and economic development. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but we do urge your support. And Mark Stevenson, he can provide a little bit more information on how it would impact his bank, as he's a community bank CEO.
Mark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And my name is Mark Stevenson, President and CEO of Capital Pacific Bank. We're a community bank based in Portland. Cedars, I just want to make a little bit of a clarification of what Cedars is. Cedars is a product that's been out since about 2003. It's has billions of dollars outstanding. We are a regular receiver of Cedars deposits for our business and nonprofit clients. We haven't ourselves had much in the way of public deposits, but one of the biggest reasons for it would be this issue that Linda referred to, which is that we need to collateralize those deposits. And frankly, a deposit that comes in that I can't deploy profitably into loans is really something that doesn't work. It's not economically feasible for our bank. So I applaud the ability to use this type of an account for public funds. So I understand that the public funds can already accept Cedars. It's just basically the difference between a certificate of deposit, which is already provided for under the law. But the this is like essentially when Linda says transaction account, it's like a money market account. So I welcome it, not just for public funds, but for, you know, it's a newer product, but it will have a lot of application with our client base that may want to have a money market account and they want all the deposits insured, but they really don't want to tie it up in a certificate of deposit. So I think it's a great innovation, and it does provide what the depositor wants, which is FDIC insurance on all of the deposits, even if it's over $250,000.
Good. I remember when we passed the original Cedars bill in 2005, when I was in the minority over on the House side. Always be nice to the people you exactly. meet on the way up, right? Buddy. In my impression is that, you know, a lot of things have gone wrong in our banking system since then, but that's not one of them. We haven't had any problems throughout the nation with Cedars. Is that your impression, as well as I see DCBS in the back of the building, too? If there have been any big problems with how the Cedars program has worked?
When we've had depositors that have wanted to understand the program for the first time, this has been research that we've conducted on their behalf as well as for ourselves, to know that that the track record with Cedars is impeccable. When banks have ever failed, which has been pretty rare because the Promontory Network, which is the administrator for these funds, does a pretty good job on being able to discern who will use and who won't, as well as our own primary regulators being the FDIC and the state. They will also get involved if a bank becomes too sick to be able to issue these types of products, and they are going to be limited or precluded from issuing them. But there have been occasionally some failures, and the deposit insurance was always paid out. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if it's a concern for the public agency that doesn't want to take a risk on their funds and they need to have it all insured, this is a good program.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add to Mark's comment, with all the concerns that folks might have about the banking system or the FDIC insurance fund, the fact is that no depositor ever in the history of the FDIC insurance fund has ever lost a penny of insured deposits, and so in terms of insuring deposits, providing for FDIC insurance of those deposits is has, as Mark said, an impeccable record of protecting the depositor. So I suppose you could ask what the constituency is that you'd be most concerned with, but in terms of the depositor, and in this case the public entity that's depositing, there's really no better track record of success than being able to utilize FDIC insurance. It has an even better track record than, you know, collateral, which does fluctuate in value.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lori Steele and David, would you mind stepping up to the table too, just so that I can get any comments from the division about this bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Lori Steele, and I'm the Marion County Treasurer. I have participated in the CEDARS program with county money in the past, with Marion County funds, so I understand that program very well. I did a lot of research before I chose to put county funds in that program, and I think I have a pretty thorough understanding of how it works. This bill kind of snuck up on me, as well as the other county treasurers in Oregon, because when we originally read this, when it came before the House, we thought that it was just a bill that made a few changes to the existing CEDARS program. And it was only last week, when I was reviewing this bill again while it was ready to come before your committee, that I realized it created an entirely new program for deposit accounts. And I've been working very hard last week and then as well as this morning to try to get some additional information to decide if I could support this bill. And I'm still undecided. I do have a number of concerns about this bill, as do some other county treasurers that I've had the opportunity to talk with this morning. I'm very concerned about liquidity needs. If I have $1 million in a bank that participates in this program and they send the money out to other banks that participate in the program and I need to access that $1 million quickly, my access to those funds is something that I'm unclear of and would be greatly concerned about. But even more than that, I think my greatest concern, and I don't know the answer to this, is as a public official, I'm responsible for the county's money that is under my authority, and I don't have the ability to analyze the banks that are used by this program, although there is a company that does that. I have pretty high standards for the funds that I am responsible for, and I will not know, I won't have the opportunity to select the banks that Marion County's money is going into. I also am not certain, and I have heard that I would not have the ability to select whether or not Marion County's funds are included in part of the program or not. That if I have funds in a bank that participates in this program, they could automatically be selected to be put into this program by the bank, and it would not be something that I would have an opportunity to choose to not participate in, and that's a huge concern for me. I don't know if these concerns are all valid because I don't have enough information, so I just wanted to express to you that I am concerned about the bill. I got an email just about an hour ago from the Clackamas County Treasurer, who could not be here today, but she does oppose the bill, and the president of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers also sent me an email, and he expressed some concern over the lack of information that he has on the administration of the program.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. Any comments that the DCBS would like to make about the, whether or not this is a risky bill, or are you comfortable with it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We don't have an official position on this bill. We didn't testify in the other house, so we don't have an official position because we didn't really integrate ourselves into the process. I will say, though, that the representations you've heard about CEDARS are the way we feel about them as well. We believe the CEDARS program is a good program, and as Ms. Navarro said, it's actually fully insured. That means not at $250,000 maximum amount, but up to the entire amount. It's just spread, the risk is spread out over a number of banks. The other point I'll just comment on is that, as Mr. Stevenson said, when we get concerned about banks, CDARS have somewhat of a mixed response in the regulatory world, in that they're concerned that the money will gets there easily and it can leave easily. So it doesn't have a stickiness to it as banks like to have. It's that relationship that we always look to. If a bank is financially struggling, if it reaches a certain level in terms of its CAMEL ratings, that's its regulatory ratings, we'll say that it has to stop receiving CDARS. And so our position is that the process will make sure that the banks involved, at least in the CDARS program, are ones that are on good financial footing. I can't address the issues that the witness just brought up, and so I'm not familiar enough with the bill, so I'm going to be happy to take any questions I can answer, but I don't profess to have any expertise.
No, that's I appreciate that. And my impression of the CDARS program since we passed the bill in 2005 has generally been a positive one, in that that I remember wrestling with that bill and getting to a comfort level, and I just wanted to get on the record that there haven't been major problems with the program. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori, thanks for coming down. I always appreciate seeing local elected officials, or local officials coming into business. Two things about this. As I understand the bill, what this does is allows you all as public officials to make the choice to enter into this program, and it would expand the amount of insurance you could get through the process. And as you just heard from ACBS, they're double-checking to make sure that those institutions have some amount of security on the backside. So I'm trying to figure out, from what your testimony is, the option is still in the hands of a public official, and our regulatory agencies are making sure that perhaps organizations that are about to fail aren't allowed to continue to participate. And since whatever relationship you have with your bank is what the relationship is with your bank, I'm trying to see if this is making you feel any more comfortable with the bill, because I think your questions are answered sort of on their face of how the process works with ECBS.
Chairman Shields, Senator George, members of the committee, I appreciate your comment, and if the public official is in fact invited to participate in the program, that would alleviate a lot of my concerns, but that is contrary to what I was led to believe this morning in conversations with the Oregon Bankers Association. I was told that it would be at the discretion of the bank. And I know the bank can choose to participate in the program or not, but my direct question was, would I have the ability to participate or not if my bank did? And I believe the answer was that it would be at the bank's discretion. If I could choose to not participate in the program, that would alleviate a lot of my concerns.
Colleagues, I think what the Bankers Association has expressed a willingness to come back up and try to clarify, but what I think I would like to do instead is roll this over till the next hearing and give you a chance to further explore with them the comfort level of your membership, and if there's a way you can get to yes by amending the bill to clarify some things, that would be my appreciation if you could get to yes on that. So that being said, I will. Is anybody else want to testify on House Bill 2613 before I close the public hearing? Okay. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2613, and again, I will be rolling this over until our next meeting date, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2614. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2614 comes from the House with a vote of 53-6. The measure eliminates the requirement that institutions holding real estate reduce the book value of that real estate under certain provisions of law by a certain amount each year. The measure has an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. There is no fiscal revenue impact to this measure. We do have in hand, and it should be with your staff measure somewhere in your packets, the -1 amendment. The -1 amendment was prepared at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and so they may be able to speak to that, although I suspect it's that the Bankers Association, which worked with them to develop that, will also be able to speak to that amendment, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, we have not yet received a fiscal impact for the -1, so if the committee desires to take action on the -1 today, we won't be able to move to the bill.
Okay. All right. So I anticipate, actually I'll put on the record now, we'll be rolling this one over as well. Could we please bring up Linda Navarro, Mark Stevenson, and David Tappan? Welcome back.
Thank you. Do you want me to first or? Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and we're here today also to urge your support of House Bill 2614, which deals with the write-down of properties that a bank has on its books. Historically, there has been a requirement in Oregon law which really just impacts Oregon banks. In fact, the same requirement doesn't exist for national banks or for credit unions in the state of Oregon. But it's really just an arbitrary 5% write-down requirement. And since the law was put into effect many decades ago, the banking industry has been obligated to follow generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP accounting. And GAAP accounting requires properties to be written down to market value as they're appraised on an, I believe, annual basis. And so the 5% requirement that's still on Oregon's books is above and beyond that in some cases. And so it actually was raised first to us as a concern by accountants who really don't like the fact that it misstates the value of a property because the bank has to write it down to GAAP accounting standards and then take an arbitrary additional 5% required by state law. Most states that had these laws on their books have started to eliminate them, and I think our neighbor states have all eliminated them because, again, banks are now following GAAP accounting. And in a declining real estate period like this, the write-downs are typically at least, if not more, than 5%. So to take another 5% on top of that, it understates the value of a property, and we've already got challenges with appraisals and things driving down the value of those properties today. So it doesn't really serve the purpose it once did, which was likely to discourage banks from hanging on to real estate on their books. And I'll just note that there's an amendment that you have that Mr. Tappan's going to speak to, and we're agreeable to that amendment, which actually reduces the time and statute that a bank has to completely get rid of those properties. It reduces it to a shorter period of time. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, I'm joined by Mark Stevenson, CEO of Capital Pacific Bank, who can speak from a community bank perspective.
Mark?
Sure. I'm not sure that I really have a lot to add to what Linda discussed because it was a pretty thorough presentation of, I think, the critical issues. There is the accountant's perspective, which says that it's not reflecting fair value. I can just tell you from an experience of as a community bank in an industry which has been, you know, under a lot of stress because of problem real estate loans, that that the requirement that we compare our loans or our assets down to these to market levels is certainly been something that's well in excess of the 5% requirement. And what doesn't make sense is that when, let's say this month I have impaired a loan by $100,000, so I've written it down by $100,000, that the very next month I need to start further writing it down by that same 5%. If you think about once we get out of this economic environment and there actually might be a price appreciation, it would be further exacerbating the accountant's concern, which is that if a property is valued at $1 million and then you're starting to write it down by 5%, but the value is still at $1 million or actually getting higher, it ends up being even further arbitrary and not logical. So I don't like it from an accounting perspective. I also don't like it from the fact that if you do have values that are being written down more than the actual market value, then it's also impacting the bank's capital, and with less capital, there's that much available to deploy into your business and making loans, et cetera.
David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, David Tappan for the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. As I probably mentioned in the past, that's the agency that regulates banks, credit unions, and other financial services. This bill, as Ms. Navarro pointed out, really stemmed from historically a practice where regulators don't want banks owning real estate property. They're illiquid, and they're not something we think that banks should hold on to, and for the most part, banks completely agree with that. And as you heard, the state of Oregon arrived at a 5% annual write-down. Different states have had different amounts in the past, but as we've moved forward, the state of Oregon was aware of the gap provisions for writing it down to fair market value, and we agreed with that. In fact, we were looking into this ourselves last summer as a possible administrative process rule, if you will. Our concern was that we wanted in the record, and this is what the amendment does, we just wanted on in the statute that this would be done pursuant to GAAP. And so you'll see in the dash one that, in fact, it speaks to that in the amendment. And then the other concern was, again, as I've said, we don't want banks holding real estate as investments. And so because we won't always be in a down period of time, there may be less incentive to sell off property, although the regulators are pretty firm about that. But 15 years is a long time to have a piece of property. So in the spirit of trying to resolve the concerns we had, we suggested 10 years, and the Oregon Bankers Association, on behalf of its members, agreed that 10 years was reasonable. In most instances, properties are going to be sold within a few years, and that's what we're seeing right now during this really difficult time. So the 10 years is really an outside mark. And with that, I'll conclude unless there's questions for me.
Senator Boquist.
I'm just curious. I mean, the last bill went through zipped and nothing, and CDAR seems a great name. I don't know what the argument is with 2613, and this one got six no votes. This is a little more complex. Is it, what concerns were raised on the House side? I mean, it makes everything you say makes sense, but obviously somebody didn't like it over there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're not quite sure what the concern was. I don't believe one of the members of my staff actually listened today to the floor debate, and there was no comments expressing concern. In the committee, there were some questions about the foreclosure process and whether this would encourage or discourage foreclosures in any way. And there may have been, you know, some confusion about the issue, but in terms of the final vote, I really can't tell you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'll close public hearing on House Bill.
Is there logic and reason from that end of the building?
Okay, so I close public hearing on House Bill 2614. Thank you, gentlemen. And we will be rolling this over until tomorrow. And I mean, until the next hearing date. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2083A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2083A was pre-session filed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, moved through the House on a vote of 59-0. The measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. We have no amendments to the bill. It exempts mortgage loan documents that are obtained by the director of DCBS during a mortgage lending examination from disclosure. The measure has an emergency clause. It would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor.
All right. Could we please bring up David Tapman and John McCulley? David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Tapman for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We sent over some testimony, I believe, to the committee administrator last week, so you should have that electronically. Is that correct? Good.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. The purpose behind this bill was one that came up last couple of years ago, and it periodically crosses our radar, and that is the balancing of access to public records versus the balancing to privacy, especially around confidential financial information. And the issue came up where people were asking for information that we obtained in an examination. Now, an examination is our primary tool for going in and looking at the mortgage lending industry. We have licensing and we have enforcement, but examination is, I think, where the rubber meets the road. We go in and we will typically examine 10 to 15 loans per loan officer to make sure that they're adhering to the law and they're making full and fair disclosure. And in the course of that process, we will probably take copies of the loan documents and take them back for as work papers to review in the process. What we have seen is with the requirements, again, increasing for information for borrowers when they're obtaining a mortgage lending, a mortgage loan on their residence, is that a lot of private information comes out. And it isn't just information that necessarily would be their tax return, but there's a lot of information today about trying to establish their ability to pay. And there may be information about what's on their credit report, and they may have filed responses why there's something on their credit report. Information that really doesn't pertain to, it pertains obviously to the person's financial situation, but isn't something that we feel like an individual would expect to ever be shared with the public. The fact of the matter is the exam papers as they are right now, unless they're subject to some other exemption such as social security number or personal bank account information or things like that, are available to the public. What this bill would do is provide a narrow exemption from public records that would allow for the individual person's information provided to the mortgage lender that through no cause other than the fact that we randomly happen to pick that file gets into the hands of the public. And we feel like this exemption would then protect that from being shared with the public should such a request come up. That doesn't mean that the examination itself isn't made public. The examination response and results are public. There's an opportunity to review the quality of work we're doing. And so we don't think this changes anything other than to provide protection for consumers through no fault of their own had their information obtained in the course of an examination. We have talked with the Attorney General's office, as I'm sure this body is fully aware. They've looked at changing exemptions for public records and alike, and when we brought this to their attention, they were supportive of the concept in general, or at least said they had no problem with what we were trying to do, and so we think it's consistent with the spirit of the public records law. And as you heard from the committee administrator, this bill either passed unanimously or virtually unanimously, and we urge your support for the bill.
John, would you like to?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley, here representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. Even though our members are not directly affected by this legislation, we do support the principle that's stated here. We think it's an appropriate public policy to protect these consumer records from public disclosure, and just wanted to let you know of our organization's support for the bill.
Okay. Any questions? All right, seeing none, I guess we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2083. And we can share the side who wants to move it. And then I guess we'll open a public hearing on 2084.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay,
sure.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2084. Same group of characters.
I believe it will be. Mr. Chair, do you want me to give a little
please
spiel?
Do.
Thank you. House Bill 2084, also a DCBS bill, moved through the House on a vote of 57-1. There was no revenue, no fiscal impact, no amendments. The measure allows the DCBS director to appoint an advisory committee to represent persons likely to be affected by mortgage lending rules that the director adopts. The measure stipulates that the director is to consider the advisory committee's suggestions, and as part of moving this bill forward, the measure has an emergency clause and would become effective upon signature by the governor. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Tatman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, one more time for the record, David Tatman with the Department of Consumer Business Services. This bill really is to address a matter that came up in 1993, and that's when mortgage lending became regulated in the state of Oregon. And at that time, it was a far different creature than we have today. And it was fairly simple, relatively speaking, between we had mortgage bankers and we had mortgage brokers, and we had no real other participants in the process. And the roles were pretty clear, and the perspectives of the two sides were probably a little more distant than they are today. Today, now we have people that are licensed as mortgage loan originators, and we have people that are consumer finance lenders that make home equity loans, and we even have more manufactured structured dealers. All these people are participating in this type of lending, and so we feel like the law really reflects a time that has come and gone. And one other point worth noting, that in In 2005, I believe it was, the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act was amended to reflect that we are expected to have an advisory committee, and that advisory committee was to represent the public and have input regarding matters that directly impacted them. And we think that it reflects that broader perspective much better reflects how we should go about conducting business. And in fact, that's how we do conduct business. We are very careful to make sure we bring all parties to the table. My concern with this, the current law that was passed in 1993, is that it allows for unexpected tripwire, and that if we didn't have that equal provision of mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers because somebody got stuck in the pass on a snowy day, then somebody could arguably say that the law that was, or the administrative rule that subsequently came out of that, was invalid. Now, that's a stretch, I'll admit, but it creates for just a trap for the unwary. We think the language in this bill is a much better way to go, and in fact is the model we understand is what the Oregon Attorney General's Office has in the Administrative Procedures Act. So again, was virtually unanimous, one vote against it. I couldn't tell you why. And I would urge this committee to support the bill as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I have a question about the language that in the bill that says may appoint and shall consider the suggestions of an advisory committee. So can you talk a little bit about if you may appoint them, but you shall consider? You said something about the Administrative Procedures Act requires some input. So I'm just trying to figure out the use of may and appoint. It's in line eight. May appoint and shall consider.
Mr. Chair, if I have a moment, I'll just go get my Administrative Procedures Act. It's right behind me.
You don't have yours.
That's the legislature in hiding.
Well, just if I could explain a little bit, because I wasn't clear, that the language that's being deleted says shall consult with an equal number, and I understand the equal number issue, but now it changes it to a may appoint and shall consider. So it looks like the appointing is discretionary, but the considering is mandatory. So if you don't appoint, then what can you consider if you haven't appointed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, so 183.333 is a provision in the Administrative Procedures Act that addresses that, and it looks to me like the language came right out of that. If you go down in subsection 1, it first has the declaration from the Assembly saying that it's the policy that whenever possible the public be involved in the process of developing rules. Then it goes on to say the legislature encourages agencies to seek public input to the maximum extent possible before giving notice of intent to adopt a rule. The agency may appoint an advisory committee that will represent the interests of the persons likely to be affected by the rule or use other means of obtaining public views. It looks to me like the may appoint was just taken right out of that. The consequences, if we don't use a public advisory committee, is that it provides us for having to go through a number of additional administrative processes down the road. It is firmly our practice that we do this in every administrative process. So it says may, and I think that's just to be consistent with the APA, but the fact of the matter is that is our practice, and I don't have a different phrase for that. I don't know why shall in 93 and may in 2010.
Thank you. And so just to clarify, if I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, that it sounds like it's your, I just want this on the record, that it's your practice to appoint, to get this input, and if you do this appointment and you have people to give you the input, you shall consider what they say.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, absolutely.
Thank you.
And again, just one other note. This is just an advisory committee. That's one step in the process. We then go through the formal notification, and usually we use advisory committee to develop the notice and the potential rule, and then we have a formal hearing, and parties are notified of that and an opportunity to speak there, too. So this is just the starting place of the process, and it isn't the only place for public input, and I hate to lose sight of that.
Thank you.
And I'm comfortable with this. One thing that I think, having witnessed the rulemaking process up close once or twice, is just how important it is to
truly get people affected by the rule itself, not just those who happen to be represented by the industry. And so I would just encourage you to make every attempt. There are more people paying attention to what happens in banking than ever before, and I'm sure we can find a lot of interested individuals to sit on that, not just people represented by those with an interest, or even those purporting to represent the public interest through some type of consumer group.
All right. Further questions? Okay. I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 2084. And is this one ready to go? And I will open a work session on House Bill 2084. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2084 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2084 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici.
Aye.
Senator Boakley.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Let's see, Senator Monroe, would you be willing to carry this?
Sure.
Senator Monroe will be the carrier, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2084. Do we need to go back to 2083?
We just did
a public hearing. Is 2083 ready to go?
Yes.
All right. I think I will open a work session on House Bill 2083. Colleagues, I had to step out for a moment, but is the comfort level of the committee such that we can move this to the floor? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I move House Bill 2083A and gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2083A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Debbie, could you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Boakley?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair
George? Aye.
Chair votes aye. Senator Boakley, would you carry this? Senator Boakley will be the carrier. I will close the work session on House Bill 2083. And colleagues, we
should roll over everything we have.
Yeah, everything else that we haven't moved today will be rolled over to, again, put that on the record. And this meeting is adjourned.